Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor of the Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome our club members and our guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On May 4th, Christopher Patton, Governor of Hong Kong, will address the club on economic and political developments in Hong Kong. On May 5th, we have acronyms on parade as Mickey Cantor, the U.S. Trade Representative, discusses GATT and NAFTA. On May 12th, Richard Riley, Secretary of the Department of Education, will address the club on the Clinton administration's education agenda. And on May 13th, Jesse Brown, Secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs, will discuss the Clinton administration's new perspectives on veterans affairs. Audio and videotapes of press club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. In case you haven't heard, President Clinton said this morning that he'd like his new ambassador to Serbia to be a Republican from Kansas. Preferably with some Senate experience. He told reporters that the appointment might not end the war with Bosnia, but both countries would certainly have balanced budgets by the end of the year. From the moment President Clinton was elected, Senator Bob Dole made it clear he was going to lead the Republican opposition. If the president proposed legislation Republicans thought was unwise, Mr. Dole said, quote, "A little gridlock might be pretty good from time to time." As Boston Globe Washington Bureau Chief David Tribune writes, quote, "The Republicans are rudderless in a crisis. They have no program and no proposals. They need a stable voice and a commanding presence. They're going nowhere, but they need someone to lead them there." Over the years, those moments have come and gone, and every time Bob Dole has made them his own. The severe Kansan, smooth and dark, has a gravelly voice and a cynical eye. End quote. Senator Dole's gridlock threat was not an idle one. Though Democrats dominate the House and have a majority in the Senate, it takes 60 votes to cut off a Senate filibuster, and Democrats have only 57. Few members could have used that slender opportunity to more advantage than the Senate Republican leader, who first came to Congress the year John Kennedy was inaugurated. Mr. Clinton's strategy for his economic stimulus bill was a head-on assault. Mr. Dole's strategy was a tank trap, 43 Republicans standing shoulder to shoulder and refusing to budge. Mr. Dole celebrated his victory by flying to New Hampshire, where he may apply for citizenship. He said, "I'm going to keep on running until I carry New Hampshire." Adding that he was only kidding. But I think Senator Dole is a perfect matchup against the Clinton administration. He has the effervescent personality of George Stephanopoulos. I'll wait. And the boyish good looks of Warren Christopher. But his tenacity is legendary. Hit by machine gun fire during World War II in Italy, Lieutenant Dole was nearly given up for dead. He spent 3 years in hospitals. "I wasn't a hero," he could joke later. "I just got shot." He entered politics on the Kansas Prairie with single-minded devotion, the first candidate to hit the streets in the morning and the last to quit at night. He never lost, entering the House in 1961 and the Senate 8 years later. He has been less successful in national politics, running once for vice president and twice for the presidency. Rumor has it that he is laying the groundwork for another campaign by purchasing a vacation home on the coast of Maine and asking Hollywood for a bit part in a motion picture. Mr. Dole's wife, Elizabeth, who has at least achieved cabinet rank as Secretary of Transportation, is here with us today, and she is president of the American Red Cross. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Republican leader of the Senate, Bob Dole of Kansas.
Thank you very much. Clayton, thank you very much. I'm not sure, I'm still going over part of it. I had a call from the White House for Leon Panetta. Is he here? No. He's probably evaluating the first 100 days, but in any event, I'm very proud to be here today. I haven't been here for a long time. Very proud to be here with many of my friends and a number of the Clinton people who came to see what we were going to say. And also proud to be here with part of our leadership team with Al Simpson and Thad Cochran, because as they know and I know, leadership doesn't amount to much unless you have some followers. And if we didn't have followers and weren't for their good efforts and the efforts of, in this last case, Senator Hatfield and others, we wouldn't have had what we think was a very important victory. So I know Al has to leave early to catch a plane for Casper, Wyoming. There's one leaves here every hour, but but not for Casper. So, you know, I had the same problem in Russell, Kansas. We don't only have two flights a day direct. But in any event, and I'm also pleased that the president of Red Cross could be here. At least she got to be president of something, which is more than many can say. So, you know, I've heard so much about the first 100 days, I'm almost ready to toss this speech out and start answering questions, because I don't know what else can be said. I think the first 100 days is sort of an arbitrary measure in any event. I don't think it really measures the success or failure of any president. Maybe it did in FDR's time. And I think this time probably wouldn't have been such a big deal, except the president himself said, and I quote, an explosive 100-day action period, and that's what he talked about. That, well, there's been a lot of action, but I don't believe the American people, and I say this as charitably as I can, were ready for the explosion of new taxes and new spending that came along with all this activity in the first 100 days. I don't believe that's the kind of change that the American people voted for, either in my state or your state, wherever it may have been across the country. And obviously it's true that President Clinton did not have a ringing mandate, as Ronald Reagan may have had in 1981, but he still had the support and the respect of all Americans after the election. When the election's over, it's over. And most Americans, including most Republicans I know, and all the Republicans I know in the Congress, and the Senate in particular, want President Clinton to do a good job, and we're prepared to support President Clinton in many, many areas, which I'll discuss just in a few moments. But I don't believe, when I hear the term gridlock, that it's fully understood or that it's ever going to catch on. So let me ask this question. Do we live in a monarchy? Is a president a president, or is he a king? Are we required by some law to accept whatever the president proposes without any opportunity for discussion, debate, or suggestion of constructive alternatives? And if we so disagree with some aspects of the president's plan, if we believe it to be truly harmful to the long-range interests of the country, are we somehow obligated to stand silent and adopt the president's plan, lest we be accused of partisanship? That's not Bob Dole asking those questions. That's George Mitchell, the majority leader of the Senate on February 8, 1992, and you can find it all in the congressional record. Now, just this last year, that rousing defense was made in defense of the two-party system, in defense of the majority at that time, and in defense of President or Senator Mitchell's assessment of President Bush. So I would say that the term gridlock maybe hadn't been used before, but the partisanship in some cases have been around for a long time. I don't fault Senator Mitchell for what he says, and I doubt that he really faults me for what we've said. Because from time to time, when there's a fundamental difference, if you're the Democratic leader or the Republican leader or anybody else in the Senate, if there's a fundamental difference, sometimes you have to take action, either try to modify or amend, or sometimes just flat out kill the proposal that might be before you. And I remember Senator Byrd, after the stimulus package had been pulled by the majority, in other words, taken down by the majority leader, he said they killed that measure without even a shotgun, they killed that measure. Well, certainly nobody understands the rules better than Senator Byrd, and he's got a trophy room full of things that he's killed over the years. And, you know, and they've all gone to West Virginia, of course, but in any event, I admire him for it. He understands the rules. He understands that sometimes we have differences of opinion and that we have an obligation, whether we're Democrats or Republicans, to speak out. And we go back, we look at the budget process, and everybody said, well, where's the Republican plan? Well, we had a Republican plan, and once we had it, nobody noted. We offered 34 amendments by Budget Committee Republicans in the budget process. Not many people noticed. So I just suggest from time to time that we have this basic fundamental difference, and we're going to try to be as constructive as we can, but at the same time, we have an obligation to a lot of people out there called taxpayers. And when I go home, when I go to Russell, Kansas, where I was about 10 days ago, it's right on the way to Iowa, when I go to Russell, Kansas, and I go to New Hampshire, which is also on the way to Russell, Kansas, get a direct flight from Manchester. But in any event, when you go home where you understand people, where you know people, and they know you, and they tell you what they think, they tell me three words: cut spending first. Now, this is not Bob Dole or Thad Cochran or Al Simpson. These are taxpayers. I don't know their political party. These are grandsons of people I knew or sons of people I knew. And they're telling me to cut spending first. When I go to Wichita, when I go somewhere else across the country, I don't check anybody's party affiliation, but they're saying cut spending first. And it may come as a big surprise to this audience, but you know, the American people don't have a great deal of confidence in Congress. I know that comes as a shock to you. They don't have a great deal of confidence in us. They don't have a great deal of confidence in the executive branch, whether it was the last administration or this administration or the administration before that. And what they believe will happen is that we'll go ahead and raise taxes $323 billion over the next 5 years, or $300 billion net, I guess, and we'll cut spending, supposedly supposed to cut spending a little bit, but they're convinced we're going to raise the taxes, and if we cut spending at all, we'll put it back in the next year, and they'll be stuck with the taxes, and spending will never be cut. So when you ask people what's more important, in a poll I saw just this morning, 84% say cut spending, 14% are concerned more about taxes. And so I just suggest that we look back, look at the first 100 days. We certainly have an obligation as Republicans from time to time to try to stand up and be constructive, and when we're opposed, to say so. And the stimulus package was an example of something that never should have been to Congress. It wasn't one of President Clinton's campaign planks. In fact, he told me he had been convinced after the election that on the margins it might have some impact. So it was nothing that he was very excited about, and it's something that I must say, I have to be very candid about this, when we had our first conference called by Thad Cochran, we sat around to discuss the stimulus package, and you might not believe this, but it wasn't the conservatives who jumped up and said, we've got to kill this package. The so-called moderate Republicans, who said to us in uncertain terms, you know, there's a fundamental difference in our position on spending and the Democrats' position on spending, because they don't want to pay for it, and in many cases it's not needed, and why should we vote for it? And so I must say I didn't develop any grand strategy. It was sort of there. It was there. And we followed up on it, and we kept ourselves together through the efforts of every one of us, because we believed that this time we were right. Next time we may be wrong, but this time we're right. So I don't believe the White House should try to blame the voters for the first 100 days. Because I think what Bill Clinton has done, and he's a very likable guy. I like President Clinton. I respect what he wants to do. I disagree with how he wants to do it. But he's not this new Democrat that was advertised in the last campaign. He said he wanted to do all these things and want to cut the deficit, and I agree we ought to cut the deficit. But I don't believe we ought to do it with the biggest tax increase in history of America. In fact, somebody said that on the Senate floor, and I think it was Senator Moynihan jumped up and said, not only in America, but in the world, the biggest tax increase. $3.23 in new taxes for every dollar in spending reduction. Now, it doesn't take any rocket scientists to figure out that's not where the American people thought they were going last November. And if you listen to Ross Perot, and many do, he's out there every day talking about the deficit. He's now talking about cutting spending first. He's lowered the rhetoric on any new taxes. And I think he understands, too, that the American people are a little nervous about taxes. And you look at the first quarter's growth of 1.8%, you got to understand a lot of people are scared. A lot of businessmen and businesswomen, particularly small business people, are scared. They don't know how the tax burden is going to affect them. They don't know how they're going to pay the new taxes. They don't see us cutting spending. They're concerned about the economy. They're not going to hire anybody. They're not going to expand their business because they're just not certain where this administration is headed. Maybe in another 100 days, it'll be clearer. Maybe not. So I just suggest that it's no accident we had this anemic last quarter growth of 1.8%. And it wasn't because we didn't pass the stimulus package. The first quarter is January, February, March. We didn't even have the stimulus package until April. So that's had no impact at all. So, but I've had a chance to talk to businessmen, businesswomen, people that you know, people are trying to make a living, people trying to create jobs in the private sector, and they want jobs. They want a jobs program. They want a jobs program in the private sector, real jobs for real people with real needs. And they think the best way to do that is by growth and by expanding the economy in the private sector. But we've said to President Clinton many times, if you can demonstrate to us that you need money for summer jobs, and you pay for it, we'll vote for it. But we're told there's still $800 million to $1 billion available right now for summer jobs. And we told President Clinton and Senator Mitchell, if you need more money for immunization and you pay for it, we'll vote for it. But we're told there's still over $200 million in the immunization program. So what's the emergency? Community development block grants that a lot of people made fun of, swimming pools and warming huts and tennis courts and golf beaches or golf courses in Daytona Beach. There's $8 billion in that program in the pipeline right now, $8 billion for community development block grants. Now, what's the emergency? Why do we need another $2.5 billion, as Senator Hatfield said on the floor time after time after time? So what I'm suggesting is this. You know, the first 100 days is over. We've also had our first 100 days. And Mike, where is Mike? He asked me yesterday what grade I was going to give Republicans. Well, I don't know, Mike. Maybe a C+. We, you know, we're not perfect. Maybe a B-. But we're still working on it. The 100 days ended at noon today. We didn't do everything right. Is that one editorial? We were sort of searching around. We were told don't do anything that might be disrespectful to the president. We didn't want to do that. We're not obstructionists. We're not there to obstruct the president's program. But we do have some philosophical differences that people expect us to enunciate from time to time. So I think it's about time we take this whole economic plan and take it into a body shop and do some work on it. You know, right now it needs a lot of work. It's got a lot of bumps and dents in it. We ought to put a crowbar to the chrome-plated tax changes. There are a lot of tax changes in that bill. And we can start by stripping off the president's painful tax on energy users, which the last time I checked means about everybody. And let me tell you why some of us say, well, we tried this broad-based tax when I was chairman of the Finance Committee. We decided we couldn't implement it. We couldn't collect it. A lot of other things we decided not to offer it. That was the best decision we made. I learned from farmers, didn't have to wait long because I thought I knew the answer. When I went back to Kansas and talked to farm groups and they came back to talk to us, you know, if you don't eat, don't worry about the farmer. But I noticed some of you ate. Farmers in Mississippi or Wyoming or Kansas or any other state in this nation, you know, they can't pass on the increased energy tax. So when it's a $500 or $700 or $1,100 additional expense to the farmer in America, the producer that produces food, the best food bargain in the world, we spend less of our disposable income on food than any other country in the world, and we got a problem. Because a farmer can't go to the elevator and say, oh, by the way, I had a $500 additional fuel bill, energy bill, just add that to my check. It doesn't happen. And notwithstanding what some people may feel about farmers, you know, they're not rolling in money. Some are, most are not. So I just suggest that they adjust their satellite dish, that high-tech group down at the White House, and tune it in on Main Street for a while. You know, start talking to real people out there. And I know they have some very bright people in the White House. In fact, I noted that in my speech to the gridiron here a while back. And I can't remember what I said, but I think I remember. I just remember not to say it again. Yeah. I think they ought to stop playing those video reruns of the campaign and maybe tune in Rush Limbaugh for a change, see what Rush Limbaugh is talking about out there. He's got a pretty big audience, and maybe tune in Ross Perot, and then now and then just tune in the Republicans. You know, we got a lot of good people in the Senate and the House who are good legislators, who are just as sensitive as other people are about the needs of the American people, who want jobs, who want to protect people on health care, want all these things that we're hearing from the White House, except we have a different, you know, a little different attitude. So let me just put it this way. We seek cooperation, but we also seek to meet our responsibilities as a co-equal branch of government. We welcome the President's initiatives, but it's not our intention to merely sit back and wait to see if the President proposes solutions to the problems facing our society. We intend to act where necessary, hopefully with the President, if necessary, without him. That's another quote from my friend George Mitchell in 1989. And I thought he pretty well was on target. And it hasn't changed that much in the past 4 years. Now, we're not perfect. We make mistakes. I know some Republicans don't agree with other Republicans. I've even found that true among our 43 colleagues. You get 43 of anything together, you've got a pretty good achievement. And you keep 43 people with different ideas, different backgrounds, different geography, different philosophies. I think it's an indication that we wanted to make a statement. We wanted to tell President Clinton and anybody else who would listen that we are responsible legislators in the United States Senate. And we're going to continue to be responsible legislators in the United States Senate. And don't try to pick off one, two, or three, or four Republicans. You know, deal with all of us. We all represent real people, and real people have real concerns. And I think if that approach is used, as I understand it's going to be used more and more, in fact, we just left a two-hour meeting with Mrs. Clinton, a very constructive meeting. She was very impressive. We talked about health care for 2 hours. Had 52 senators there, 26 Republicans, and 26 Democrats. And we asked tough questions, and she gave us answers. And that's the kind of dialogue the American people want. And that's the kind we hope we're going to have. Now, I've just mentioned two or three things that I think we're going to be seeing more of from our side. Crime. What's happened to the crime issue? Our view is it should be addressed. Certainly Al Simpson on that committee has done an outstanding job. But we intend to introduce a tough anti-crime bill that will put more police on the streets, devote more resources to prosecuting gang activity, and build more federal prisons. And best of all, we're going to find a way to pay for it. We're not just going to charge it up to your children or your grandchildren. We're going to do that. We're also concerned about health care, as I just said. And we've got a lot of outstanding players on health care. Senator John Chafee from Rhode Island is the chairman of the Republican Task Force. He's been meeting almost every Thursday for the past 2 years. And others, Senator Dernberger, Senator Coates, Senator McCain, Senator Cochran, all these, we've all been trying to work together to find some way to make it affordable and accessible to every American. And believe me, that's not easy. And when Mrs. Clinton was asked today about the cost, I think she very correctly stated, we don't know yet. We're still trying to find out ourselves how much it will cost, can we save money, or will it cost money, and how are we going to pay for it? She didn't indicate there would not be a value-added tax to pay for it, which is, I think, good news, because on April 15th, there was some suggestion the value-added tax might be used for health care. So I just suggest that these are areas we're working on. I know the focus of the first 100-day report cards and all this has been focused on the disagreement with the Clinton administration. Let me just touch on a couple of areas where we think we not only have agreement, where we may be the ones that are helping the president move the legislation. North American Free Trade Agreement. Just yesterday, a letter was delivered to President Clinton signed by 26 Republicans saying, let's move ahead. Trade's very important. Let's don't wait for side agreements. Let's take care of it in some other way. Let's get it done. And I think the president will appreciate that support, and we're anxious to work with him. So-called Russian aid. I don't view it as Russian aid myself. I think there's a distinction here. It's not a foreign aid package. If we're talking about our national interests in this case, we're talking about future conflicts, more arms build up, spending billions and billions of dollars if something happens and democracy goes down the tube in the former Soviet Union. I pledge my support. I can't speak for all Republicans, but I don't want to tie it to some new stimulus package. That's the non-starter as far as this senator is concerned. I read some report today that that might be a new strategy. And finally, I would just touch on another foreign policy issue. You know, foreign policy in a campaign, you'd ask people about foreign policy, it didn't even register. Maybe 1 or 2 or 3 or 5% thought foreign policy was important. Well, President Clinton is finding out, as President Bush did, that foreign policy is important and takes up a lot of your time. And right now, President Clinton is wrestling with a very difficult decision. What do we do about Bosnia? What is our national interest? What do we tell the American people if the president decides lift the arms embargo, which I think is the minimum we should do, and I support the president if he should do that, and airstrikes? And what happens if we have airstrikes? And where do we draw the line? In Serbia or just in Bosnia? And what happens if they move the artillery into civilian areas? And you'll see on the nightly news maybe civilians who've been wounded or killed by American bombs. So it's a very, very difficult decision. And again, I commend President Clinton for spending 2 hours with a bipartisan group 2 days ago discussing or consulting with us about that particular foreign policy issue. And again, there's no Republican Party position. I think we're split down the middle. I think the American people are split down. They're not even split down the middle. But sometimes leadership requires not to wait for the 80-20 for you. Leadership may require you go against the 80 if you're 20. And President Clinton right now is wrestling with that tough decision. And as I've indicated to him, I'm prepared to support him. I think first we need to define our national interest, and secondly, we need to make certain we've got our allies on board and as much as possible the American people on board, because the American people are very concerned. And finally, with that issue, no U.S. ground troops, and we don't do it alone. We do it under the NATO umbrella, or we don't do it. We don't go off on our own without the support and actual participation of our allies. So just let me close by saying that, you know, the next 100 days has already started about an hour ago. And maybe the next 100 days is going to be better for all of us, particularly the American people. That's the one special interest that I think we all have responsibility for, whether you're the president or a member of Congress or working in Washington in any other capacity. The American people, I think for the most part, they want change. But as I said at the outset, the change they want is they want us to cut spending first, cut the cost of government, do all these things before you ask us, the taxpayer in America, to cough up another $300 billion net in new taxes. And the American people don't understand, you know, why we're spending more and more money instead of talking about reducing spending. That's the big issue. So we're prepared to work with President Clinton if he wants to start over on a new budget, on a new economic plan that cuts spending, then he'll have some Republican support. But I've got to believe, before the question comes, I'll try to respond. Keep in mind that I think his package may be hanging by a thread. I don't see how any Republican can support that big a tax increase. That's 43 votes in the Senate. We'll have 44 by then because we're going to win the Texas seat in about 5 weeks. So that'll be 44 votes. And then if Senator Shelby votes with, that's 45. We've offered to make him the Republican leader if he'd like to switch parties. So that means you only need five more. If Gore's out of town, if he's in town, you need six, and I assume he'd be here. But that's Vice President Gore, excuse me. So I would just say that, as I said earlier, this might be a time for going into the body shop and repairing the economic plan and make it more responsive to the concerns and the real concerns of the average American taxpayer up and down Main Street, USA. Thank you very much.